Coming up on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast.
So Flatley's on the line, actually. Would you say hello to him?
Okay.
Say hello to him.
Hi, Michael.
Abby Jesus Bill. Bill me old McCushla. Bill be Jesus. It is 25 years since I talked to you, and there you are. Be Jesus Bill. I can't believe it. You're rustling up all the thoughts in me Irish mind now. Yeah. When you and I came butted heads together, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
The tectonic plates were moving.
Well, you got a taste of the old Munster rugby there, Michael.
That's so, it. I love
I was
it.
Gentle with you.
I love it. Come but on, I was good to you. I was good to you, and you were good to me. And be Jesus, they say, Bill, I did you ever see that film? Every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings. Well, oh, yeah. I tell you, they say every time Riverdance plays, Bill gets a big check through the door.
Oh, Michael, you're never lost it, really.
Ah, be Jesus. Bill Whelan was not expecting to get a call from Michael Flatley during our conversation for this week's episode. I actually think that Bill didn't know that we did this item on the thing. And I think he thought that it was actually Flatley on the phone at the beginning before he saw me doing it. But despite the fact that they haven't always seen eye to eye, it all seemed to go pretty well. The two men, of course, worked together on Riverdance. The legendary, legendary Riverdance. All spawned from that 7-minute piece of music that Bill Whelan composed himself, for he is the composer of Riverdance. Flatley was his lead dancer along with Gene Butler. Arguably, it was a piece of music and dance that changed the face and perception of Ireland, maybe forever, along with Jack Charlton and the World Cups, 2 World Cups, 1 European Championship. We won 4 Eurovisions, I think, in a row. We had a dot-com boom. The economy was flying. We emerged from the kind of depression of the 80s, and it kind of heralded in, or it was kind of symbolic of, a little mini renaissance of Ireland and indeed Irishness, but not just twee Irishness, a kind of a new modern Irishness, which proclaimed itself to the world, if that's not too much to say. Now, Bill has just published his memoirs, The Road to Riverdance, but it's not all about Riverdance. Bill is an incredibly interesting fellow, with having had an amazingly colourful professional life. He has written and produced music for all the greats, including U2. He worked with them on their album War. Kate Bush, he worked with her on Hounds of Love. And Van Morrison. In this conversation, which I loved every minute of, because Bill not only is a good storyteller, but he has a beautiful voice as well, I think anyway. He shares some fascinating stories from his career.
When I wrote the piece da, da, dee, da, 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 for his entrance, he says, Bill, write me a piece and I'm going to go bam.
I'm going to go bam.
I'm going to go bam. I said to her, you know, I said, when I was working in the industry in Ireland, you know, it wasn't cool to be Irish. You know, if you go to England and, you know, they kind of treat you a little bit like, you know, oh, here's your man from...
God, things have changed.
Yeah, exactly. And she said to me, well, that's very funny, she said, because when I was growing up, it was very cool to be Irish. Mm. And suddenly the weight of that hit me. I just thought, God, she's right. The first bit I wrote was the slip jig for Gene Butler.
That's it.
Exactly.
That's it. That's that the first bit that came to you?
That's the first bit. Oh, hi, Louis.
Bill, it's incredible to talk to you. I always said, Bill, you're going to be huge. You're going to be huge. You are a star, Bill. People always ask me, where did the Carter twins first meet? The worst question that you could ask them.
Yeah, go on.
They're twins, Bill!
My full chat with Bill coming up in just a couple of minutes. But first, it's comedy time. Did you hear the news? I couldn't believe it. My jaw dropped. But this is true, folks. This is true, so I'm not making this up. Ronan O'Gara, our legendary out half, legendary Triple Crown winner, is apparently in the frame for the England rugby job. Apparently, he is in the shortlist of 3 names. And apparently, he is happy with this. The Mario Rosenstock podcast managed to hack Ronan O'Gara's voicemails. Here they are.
Hi, you've reached Ronan O'Gara. For corporate gigs, press 1. For paid sponsorships, press 2. For paid leadership seminars, press 3. To leave a message, press 4.
Rog, This is Polly. It's what I'm hearing true, Rog, that you're in the shortlist for the English job. This would constitute treason, Rog. Call me immediately.
Good afternoon, Rog. This is Taoiseach Micheál Martin calling here. As a Munster man, but more specifically, Rog, as a Cork man, I would urge you to reconsider this insane course of action going forward. Please, don't hesitate to get in contact with me. Thank you. All credit to curveballs. Rog, this is Roy. Are you out of your fucking mind? England. England. Walk away from your own country. You know my number, call me.
Rog, this is Boris Johnson. Huzzah for rugby. Wonderful, wonderful to hear the news that you may be indeed taking the Queen's shilling and returning to the mainland from the colonies very, very shortly. What a day it'll be with the rose on your tracksuit as you singing God Save the Queen. Ipso facto, fantastic news.
Rog, Polly, it's been 2 hours and 15 minutes. If you do not call me now, I will personally go over to La Rochelle on a ferry and rip your
Rog, this is Draco. As a former international teammate, I was perturbed, Rog, by the news concerning England. Perhaps some kind of compromise can be reached, Rog. Maybe Leinster instead of England. I don't know. I could pull some strings. Let's get this done, Rog. This would be a bad move. Call me, Rog. Leinster, call me.
Ronan, this is Rishi Sunak, Prime Minister of Great Britain. It's great to hear the news. If there is anything I can do to expedite the situation, even before the World Cup. Swing low, sweet chariot. Roger's going to carry us home.
Rog, Polly, England was one thing. But Leinster, you're dead to me, Rog.
Oh my God, the SHIT will hit the fan in a big way if he ever goes to England. Or even worse, Leinster. Every week, I ask you to follow the podcast, rate and review it if you're feeling generous. But mostly, I ask you to tell one person about this podcast. That's all. Just, if you do like the podcast, just tell one person who you kind of know doesn't listen to it and go, have you ever listened to the Mario Rosenstock podcast? Give it a listen. And I'd really appreciate it if you could do that. You can also get in touch with me if you want, personally. MarioRosenstock@gmail.com. I read all of them and I get back to about 95% of them. There's some who I have to get back to now. I haven't got back in a few weeks, and I will get back to you. Lockie Butler, old friend of mine, if you're listening, I'll get back to you soon, Lockie. And great to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening and recommending us and getting in touch, of course, by email and telling your friends. Okay, let's meet Bill Whelan. As I mentioned, he's worked with so many of the greats of music in Ireland and beyond. However, his big breakthrough hit was Riverdance. So, of course, we had to kick off with Riverdance. So, Bill, great. Thanks for joining me on the
Pleasure.
Podcast. And your book is a memoir, and I have it here in front of me. And it's a picture of you and your father on the front cover.
Mm.
And is that a motorbike?
It's a motorbike.
What kind of a motorbike?
A Triumph.
The Triumph. Gabo used to love them as well.
Yeah.
And the book is called The Road to Riverdance. And why wouldn't it be? Because although you have distinguished yourself as a composer, an arranger, musician throughout your career, and worked with all sorts of people. You were saying Richard Harris there, Kate Bush, Fan the Man, you know, U2, you name it, you know, as well as being a successful commercial jingle writer as well. I'd like to talk to you about that at some
sure.
stage.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, you're indelibly linked with
Riverdance.
With Riverdance. Just so, I mean, you know, because it is a while ago now, so let's just, for our audience even, let's try and throw together just a couple of statistics, just to realise how big this thing is and has been. Let's throw together a few statistics. So, 1994
was the first 7 minute piece.
Yeah.
Which we did in Eurovision, which kind of took everybody by surprise.
Mm.
And that was, well, there were 300 million viewers at that.
Yeah.
Know? And
so its first outing was in front of a lot of people.
It did, yeah, it did. And then, luckily, I had the single ready to go of the music. And it was in the charts the next week. And it went straight to number one.
Yeah.
And it was number one for 18
How
weeks.
Long is that track?
7 minutes.
7 minutes.
And nobody would give me, I had no money at the time, and nobody would give me any money to make the record. I ended up going to an insurance company, believe it or not, who I did a jingle for years ago. And I said, listen.
What was the insurance company?
Church and General, they were called. Okay. And I went, so I, I went to them and I asked them, I said, look, I have a project, and I found myself in the bizarre situation of sending a cassette of my home demo of Riverdance over to an insurance company. And I kind of thought I might hear no more of it. And then I got a phone call.
What were you looking for, Bill?
I was looking for money to make the record.
To produce
the record, pay for the orchestra, pay for the musicians, okay, pay for the studio. And nobody in the record industry would back it because they said, look, it's 7 minutes long.
Yeah.
There's no artist to promote it. No. Come on, get real.
No, it is an odd sell.
I admit it. Mm. I admit it. It was a little daft. Mm. But anyway, Church in General came back and said, listen, we've listened to that. Tell us what it's about. I said, look, it's going to be in the middle of Eurovision. It's, as you heard, 7 minutes long. It's an Irish dance piece. And they said, you know, we like it. How much are you looking for? So I told them, I think I was looking for about $7,000. Mm. And they said, we'll give you that. And so I was able to make the record. So the result was that when Riverdance happened in 94, we were ready the next week with the record, and it went straight to number one. And that is what, it was number one for 18 weeks, all through the summer after Riverdance, it was number one. And that kept, and then Wogan
started playing
it. Yeah, he started playing it, then it went into the British charts. And so the whole thing took off, but that's what really kept the memory of Riverdance on that night alive until we were able to put together the full show, which was a different...
Okay, I want to come back to that in a minute, right? So just again for the people, so 1994, the record goes to number one. It's a 7 minute piece in the interval piece.
Yeah.
It's 300 million viewers. Then the next year, there's a stage show, Riverdance it's called, Michael Flatley, Gene Butler. It's an immediate hit. It goes on in the Point Depot.
It went on at the Point first for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And then it went to London for 10 days.
Yeah.
And then it came back to the Point and it ran for 10 weeks.
Okay.
And then we had booked an English long booking in the Hammersmith Odeon.
England,
in London. And we went back to Hammersmith. And the night we opened, Michael Flatley was no longer with the show.
Yeah.
And we've been running since.
Yeah. And America?
America, China.
Everywhere, China.
Yeah.
And they call it almost the tributaries of Riverdance then, because they had different Riverdances.
That's right. At one stage, we had three permanent companies running, and they were all named after Irish rivers, the Lagan, the Liffey, the Lee, and the Shannon, by the way.
Got that in there.
Yeah. And then we had another group, which was called the Flying Squad. And they would come around and do, like, if somebody was some rich person in the States wanted a party.
Corporate.
Yeah, corporate. They'd fly out and do it. So it was like there were years of that. A lot of activity, a lot of auditioning people, a lot of auditioning dancers, musicians. Yeah. And I knew,
for example, you knew that it was massive when we were watching Friends in the 90s, and Chandler started doing it.
Yeah.
Chandler started going, it's like Flatley. And you're going, my God, they're talking about it as if it's just a normal conversation among New Yorkers.
Yeah, and it was three times on The Simpsons.
Three times on The Simpsons.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it?
It was, yeah. They had three different sketches over the history of The Simpsons when the music was used.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
And Bill, and so again, people listening, right? Bill, so you wrote this iconic piece of music, and it isn't just an iconic piece of music. It's a bloody great piece of music, and I'll tell you why, because you know I work with Ian Dempsey in the mornings, mm-hmm. and like we play pop records, so we play Shakira and we play, you know, Lady Gaga and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But every so often Ian will just pull it out and he'll go, here it is. Here's Riverdance.
Mm.
And it'll be 7 minutes and we play the full 7 minutes, no truncated, no cut off. And the texts then start flying in, and they're all kind of the ones that stick with me are the one go, hairs standing on the back of my neck, Ian, had to stop the car. I just wanted to listen to it. Other people are going, bawling my eyes out here, and they're not bawling their eyes out in sadness. It's joy.
Yeah.
There's something incredibly joyful about it. There's a nostalgia to it as well as the years go by, because this particular period of time, 1994, if you look back on it, Bill, it was an interesting time for us, wasn't it?
It was a very interesting time in many ways, actually, because first of all, I think, you know, and I write about this in the book, I came sort of through the Irish music industry from the time that it was kind of basically a showband industry.
Mm.
And the record industry in Ireland basically made showband records to promote showbands to play in the halls.
Mm.
And that was the circle. In the late 1970s, when Mullane opened up, And suddenly we had a recording facility in Ireland, which was world class. And that brought in a lot of artists. And for instance, it brought in people like Kate Bush and people that I ended up working with. Yeah. And 94, the peace process, you know, there was a lot of stuff kind of happening socially. And of course, the so-called Celtic Tiger. Yeah, for which we accept no responsibility, by the way. But anyway, yeah, it was. And it had that position. I remember there was a pub in Limerick that used to, when the Angelus rang on the 10 RTE at 6 o'clock, they would put in a cassette of Riverdance. So it had that kind of, it did have that kind of cultural resonance. Yeah.
There was a football phenomenon as well.
There was, exactly.
So 1988, 1990 and 1994, Giant Stadium, New York, Irish people go to America to take over in America. There was the dot-com boom. Yeah. And of course, Ireland was benefiting from that, the intels of this world. Yeah. And there was, underneath all of this and behind it all, there was a sense that we were coming out of the miserable 80s, which were unlike any miserable time we'd had in our history. It was really, truly miserable. It's reeling in the years wouldn't have been made if we hadn't had the 80s.
Yeah.
With Mary Black singing, you know, Nadine as an Aer Lingus plane takes off to go to the States.
Yeah.
And a poor little redheaded ginger fella going, I'm just going to the States. Why? Because there's nothing here for me.
Yeah.
What can you do there? I don't know. Yeah. I'll just go. And then Nadine, and then, you know, taking off. And that was what the 80s were. But this was different. And so when that standing ovation happened for Riverdance after 7 minutes,
yeah.
It was like as if, I don't know, it's like as if you could look back and you go, here we are, we've arrived on the world stage with something that is genuinely not diddly idle do Irish. There was something quite spiritual about it and moving.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think what was happening was, well, first of all, like I came up through, shall we say, the big, after Seán Óriadh, after Seán Óriadh in the 60s and 70s, all that happened, the Chieftains, Planxty, that great thrust of invention in Irish music and a way of presenting Irish music in a new way, that was all happening and had been happening. So I guess I was a member of Planxty for a couple of years and worked with them. And so I was part of what was going on there. And then over sort of on a siding, in a way, you know, kind of railway siding, was Irish dance, which still existed very, very actively and very alive in the competition culture.
Mm-hmm.
And what Riverdance did, I think, mostly in terms of the cultural impact of it, was it got the dance and the music together.
Mm.
And we presented the dance as a piece of theatre, as opposed to just something that you mark down. Oh, yeah, they got that role right, and this. You know, it wasn't just classical dance. It was now a piece of theatre, and that coming together of the music and the dance in Riverdance was actually a very important moment, I think. And what we've seen ever since then is the whole development of dance schools. You know, there's a whole bunch of people now teaching dance all around the world, teaching Irish dance. And also the dance itself has developed. You know, it's no longer, you know, the arms down by the side and the very, very rigid. Mm. And part of that, Mario, I think, was that we were kind of clinging on to a sense of Irishness, as in not Britishness, from going back to the foundation of the state and De Valera's time, all of that. This was us, that we were Irish, and anything outside of that was not accepted. Then we had the 60s and the big revolution in the 60s with the music and all of that. Mm. And that suddenly, I think, what happened was we got a new confidence to say, okay, we're Irish. We can reach back into the tradition, but we can also bring our current creativity to bear on it.
Yeah.
And that happened.
And that's what it is. That's what it is. So the original piece was 7 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
And is that all you wrote at the beginning?
Yeah.
So you just wrote 7 minutes.
You wrote it
as a commission for the Eurovision.
Yeah.
Okay. And how long did that 7 minute piece take you to write?
I would say from about, I first met Moya Doherty in December of 1993. And I had done The Spirit of Mayo before that. And she had seen that and said to me that a lot of the elements that I had put into The Spirit of Mayo would be very interesting in a thing for the middle of Eurovision. So there was Anuna, for instance, the choir. Mm. They were in the Spirit of Mayo. There were the drummers. Mm. They were in the Spirit of Mayo. So we met in 93, and then I think I started to write it after Christmas of 1994. Mm. And then we were in rehearsal and on, you know, in a couple of months. So I probably wrote, because there was back and forth as well with the choreographers. When Mavis Ascott, the choreographer, the staging choreographer, when she came in, and when Flatley and Butler came in, you know, that took, you know, there was back and forth. Mm. We changed the length of things. You know, you look at it on stage, you say it takes 8 bars to get from there to there instead of 4. You know, so there was a lot of kind of interplay at the beginning. Mm. And then finally we arrived at the piece. Mm. And in this very location, in Diggs Lane, we rehearsed.
That's right. This is where the rehearsals. Yeah, yeah. And on this floor.
On this floor, was it?
Yeah, I think it was. That's right.
Yeah, yeah. So we started rehearsals, and it just, I just remember seeing it for the first time when all of the elements came together. You know, the two principals, Flatley and Butler, the drummers, the choir, all of that. When all that came together, then we got a hint that this was something that was a little out of the ordinary. Mm-hmm. And that was just presented with, you know, the home demo and, you know, dancers in there, just fleckies, you know, nothing spectacular. But there was an energy and a power right there from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Forward. What was the first part? Riverdance is a 7-minute pop song.
Yeah.
You know, Bohemian Rhapsody is 7 minutes as well, or 5.5, 6 minutes. Mm. I mean,
MacArthur Park was.
Yeah. It can work, but Riverdance is a 7-minute. What was the first bit of it that came to you or that you liked yourself?
The first bit, actually.
And hum it if you can.
And the first bit I wrote was the slip jig for Gene Butler.
What's that now?
It's a piece in 9/8.
Okay.
A particular rhythm which she wanted to. She asked for a slip jig.
You're above my pay grade now, Bill. Okay, will you just hum it for me or something, will you?
That's
it.
Exactly.
That's it. That's that the first bit that came to you?
That's the first bit. That's later.
No, that's the end, but I'm saying it goes into a kind of a.
It goes in
a pre.
Well, first of all, it goes into a thing. First of all, there's a big entry for Michael.
Yeah.
Which is that's the first bit, and then it goes into a piece in mixed time. Now, this is where it's interesting because I wrote this piece in 2 time signatures, 6/8 and 4/4. So it went jagada dagada bat da 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 dagada dagada da 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 da.
What's that called?
Well, it's called mixed time. It's 6/8, 4/4.
Okay.
So a bar of 6/8 and a bar of 4/4. And which would be very unusual in Irish dance.
Is it?
And totally.
That sound is unusual.
Yeah.
That's unusual, is it? Okay.
Yeah. So it's like a jig, which is da 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 da, and 4/4 da ba da 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 da. You know.
Yeah.
So the two of them are mixed.
Okay.
It's like a 6/8 and then a 4/4.
Okay.
So
that's, you were bringing something eclectic to the form.
Correct. Mm. And partly my own interest in jazz, in Dave Brubeck, and all of that stuff that I grew up listening to. I was always fascinated by mixed time signatures, and then. Also, I worked a lot with Eastern European music and Andy Irvin. So I did a whole album of Eastern European music in 1980.
How interesting.
And so the Eastern music, Eastern European music, virtually none of it is divisible by 2. So it's all like 7s, 9s, 11s, 13s, 15s, you know. Whereas, yeah, so and it's really interesting to watch Eastern European music. I went to a Cayley in Budapest. Mm. And the Cayley in Budapest was all these, you know, grandchildren, grandfathers, parents, all in a room like we'd have a Cayley here. But they're all dancing in these. And these odd time signatures.
I get you. Now that you say it, I get you.
Yeah.
So I get you. I actually see a kind of, I hear an Eastern European sensibility now that you remind me of it.
Yeah.
And this is fascinating. So, and this is, of course, perhaps let's ruminate for a second.
Okay.
And I'm sure you have. Mm. This is possibly what instinctively made it interesting to people and attractive. That they were going, there's something of me in this. There's something of my culture in this song. Hmm. This is Ireland, yes, but they're speaking to me.
Yeah.
I'm from another place, not Ireland. And yeah, they're speaking to me. This music seems to be speaking to me.
Yeah, it may have resonated for from people from Eastern Europe who kind of, you know, are not are totally at home with that kind of mixed times. Yeah. For us, it was, the challenge was for the choreographers to make steps that would fit these odd time signatures. Yeah. And that was really the challenge. And then the big moment was, and again, this is reflected in the choreography, the big moment was when we went out of that broken time, which I often think creates a kind of a tension. It creates a tension in your body clock because it's not quite regular. It's broken.
Yeah. And it's not orthodox.
And it just creates a kind of a tension. Mm. And it went straight into straight into a 4/4 feel. Well, actually a jig, but like with that pounding 4/4. Mm. And suddenly that released the tension that was built up with the
I see what you mean.
Into that.
Yeah.
It was like...
gave it a momentum then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so you mentioned the steps there and everything. Yeah. And of course, when you say the steps, you know, the two, Michael Flatley and Gene Butler.
Yeah.
So when you first laid eyes on Michael Flatley, when you first met him, tell me about meeting Michael Flatley. Tell me about the impression he made on you. This incredible man, let's face it.
Yeah, well, the first time I met him, you know, I was really impressed with his... You know, he was a very polite young man, you know, very in that, you know, that sort of American politeness.
Yep.
Very, very polite.
Deferential.
Correct. And then I saw him. I remember going into the studio with him and he put on his dance shoes and he did a few steps. And I looked at him and I thought, OK, this guy really is special. And
really?
He was. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Do you mean you could literally tell immediately that
you could just tell that his sense of rhythm, his footwork was...
Sense of rhythm.
His sense of rhythm and his footwork were exceptional to me.
Mm.
Now, you know, there are probably dance teachers in Chicago who are saying, for God's sake, you know, we had six guys, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But to me, he was really unique. And I saw that. And we worked together, you know, a lot at the start to bring together that, to give him an opportunity. And I remember he used to say, when I wrote the piece for his entrance, he says, Bill, write me a piece and I'm going to go bam. And he was, like, he had such a sense of kind of bravado theatrics.
Yeah.
You know, and when we saw
which is lovely.
Yeah. And when we saw him in the Spirit of Mayo, he was doing the moonwalk, you know, the Michael Jackson moonwalk, you know.
Yeah, was he?
He was, yeah. And he, at that stage, he'd been dancing with the Chieftains.
Yeah. Was he an innovator himself or is that overcooked?
That's a very good question. You know, he certainly was innovative in that he brought a sense of theatre, bravado, show to the dance. That, you know, you sometimes see Irish guys dancing and they're a little bit more, you know, diffident and not quite pushy. Mm. Michael had no problem in that area. Mm. So, yes, he was definitely, he was breaking new ground, I think. Mm. Now, whether his style of dance ultimately became very challenging to other dancers, I'm not sure, you know. But, I mean, he definitely was a very, very theatrical dancer.
Did you have cause to fall out with him during this process?
Not in the original Riverdance, no.
But then?
When we went on to the two-hour show, we had a few disagreements.
What would they be about?
Well, they would be about, you know, I was working probably at least 18, 20 hours a day.
Trying to get this two-hour piece.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a time that we were really up against it in terms of time. And he went off on holidays.
Yeah.
And that, you know, amongst professional colleagues, that doesn't really create a good vibe that you're going off on holidays. So he went off on holidays, he came back, and then certain things weren't, in my view, ready. And he and I had some very frank, well, I was pretty frank, but I was at that stage, you know.
How is he in a confrontational situation?
He was okay. He was okay. I can't say that he. He was. You know, he has that underlying politeness, Michael.
Yeah.
And people who meet him will always say that, you know.
He has a fieriness, though, as well.
There is. I mean, he's definitely, he's going in a direction and you just better stand back because he's coming through.
Bill, I just have to interrupt now because you know that there's some people who I invite to listen to this podcast.
Oh.
And they listen live. Sometimes they're in their cars on the way home. Some of them are famous. Some of them aren't famous.
Okay.
And I did put the word out and he said, yeah, he's listening. So Flatley's on the line, actually. Would you say hello to him?
Okay.
Say hello to him.
Hi, Michael.
Abby Jesus Bill. Bill me old Makushla. Bill be Jesus. It is 25 years since I talked to you and there you are. Be Jesus Bill. I can't believe it. You're rustling up all the thoughts in me Irish mind now and how deferential and polite I was, be Gabson. And how you used to come up to me and roar the head off me, so you did, Bill. Bill, people don't know out there, he's an animal. He's an animal, so he is. Be Jesus, he's a wolf in sheep's clothing.
I was worried because of your uncle, the tinker, Flatley. That was, I thought I might draw the ire on the whole family.
I tell you, you'll draw more than the ire now. You'll draw the bam. I'll bring the bam back down on you. Wham, bam, thank you, Bill, ma'am. I'm telling you now, me granddaddy, the tinker Flatley, he was a tinker out of Castle Troy in County Limerick.
Was he?
Okay. He said to me, a vicoline, a trout in the pot is better than a salmon in the sea. But there's no need to fear an ill wind when your haystacks are tied down. But hell hath no fury like a tinker scorned from Limerick.
The old Irish.
And that's what you're from yourself, Bill. Be gods and be Jesus, I tell you.
God, yeah.
When you and I came butted heads together, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
The tectonic plates were moving.
Well, you got a taste of the old Munster rugby there, Michael.
That's it. I
was gentle with you.
I love it.
Come
but
on.
I was good to you. I was good to you and you were good to me. And begobs, we both made our millions out of it. And we're both two humble old Irish gobshites. You there hocking your old book, pretending you have not a penny to rub together and not toot crew beans. And every time they say, be Jesus, they say, Bill, did you ever see that film? Every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings. Did you ever see that film?
I didn't see that, no.
Well,
no,
I tell you, they say every time Riverdance plays, Bill gets a big check through the door.
Oh, Michael, you're never lost it, really.
Ganairi on Boverlet.
Ganairi indeed.
Tán Milshán Aaron Twinog.
A Milshán. Okay.
Yeah. Tán Madra Dunta. Agastama Lea Rodi at Jack Galair.
I don't know what he's saying there, but that's lovely to
see. It was nice, great to hear him.
Ah, brilliant to hear him. And he was good to ring into you.
Yeah, he was.
He was good to ring into you.
Yeah.
That is actually true, though, isn't it? I mean, because I think a little birdie told me that, let's face it, Bill, right? I mean, I'm only guessing here, right? But let's face it, you became a wealthy man from Riverdance.
Yeah, but remember this, Mario. Mm. In my lifetime, that amount of money, and I'm not just talking about me, I'm talking about everybody who writes music nowadays.
Yeah.
How diminished that has become because of the internet and because of downloading, because of Spotify.
But you still get it for a performance.
You still
for
get
a live
it
performance.
For a live performance.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And of course, that was one of the main income streams.
It was. If it weren't for the live.
Mm.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic, though. So, I mean, you'd nearly need a man now or a woman just keeping track on. Was there another performance out in Australia there that I need to know about? Because I'm waiting for that little check come through the door. But it's fantastic, isn't it? It's fantastic that you chose the love of your life, presumably, music.
Yeah.
And by God, it came through for you. How important is it for you, in your mind, that you went from being a person who clearly loves what they do, to practicing what they do, to making a living what they do, maybe to making an average living what they do? Because let's face it, a lot of your work would have been in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And Ireland, as you said, through the show Bandera, it's you know, it was a smaller market.
Mm.
And then to really kind of going in and to making a killing, if you like, from this. Is that a great joy in your life? Or are you the kind of person to go, do you know what? I don't care either way.
Hmm.
Or do you care either way?
Of course, one cares, shall we say. Hmm. I mean, I used to get asked one of the most common question, and you haven't asked this, Mario.
I don't ask common questions.
You don't. You certainly don't. And you've great guests on the show. but one of the most common questions I was asked, in fact, the most common question, did I know when I was writing Riverdance that it was going to be the success that it was?
Mm.
Now, you wouldn't believe how many times I've been asked that question. So much so that I sort of almost felt like answering at one stage, Yeah, I did. I just put off doing it until I was 45.
Just to wait until you needed the old pension.
Exactly. So, I mean, the thing about it is that, yeah, it did. It was very good. It ended up, you know, because there were years in the 70s and 80s, even though I seemed to be working all the time, there were years when it was grim.
Yeah.
And I went to America, tried to break in America, do things, take productions I had done here to America to see if I could break in. And I spent a whole summer going around the record companies trying to see if I could find a way where they might give me some work.
Mm. And what was America like in terms of their... Let's say, what's that process like, going knocking on the door in America and taking music there?
Well, funnily enough, it was easier in some ways than the UK, because the UK had the old colonial attitude to Ireland. Mm. You know, we were a small country, you know, making country and Western music, and they didn't really see us as, until U2 came along.
Yeah.
They didn't really see us as being serious. In fact, the whole, and I was just talking about this the other night, the whole traffic that happened after the birth of U2 and everything that happened after that. See, before that, people had to go away. Mm. Lizzie, everyone went away, made their careers abroad. Mm. U2 and Win Mullane stayed here. Mm. They hired Irish talent and they kept the talent in the country. And suddenly we went from being an importing industry into being an economy that was actually exporting. You know, it's interesting. I was doing an interview with somebody recently who was a young woman for one of the newspapers. And I said to her, you know, I said, when I was working in the industry in Ireland, you know, it wasn't cool to be Irish. You know, if you go to England and, you know, they kind of treat you a little bit like, you know, oh, here's your man from...
God, things have changed.
Yeah, exactly. And she said to me, well, that's very funny, she said, because when I was growing up, it was very cool to be Irish. Mm. And suddenly the weight of that hit me. I just thought, God, she's right. That in my lifetime, you know, that the traffic changed, that it was now cool to be Irish.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, to me, you've no idea how... I know this sounds ridiculous. Where have I been? Have I been asleep?
No.
But it just, to me, it sounded like, wow, you know, that's probably right.
Were you involved in some of the early U2 stuff, like War? You were involved in War.
Yeah, I did.
Tell me about your involvement in that.
Well, that was, I'd been working in the studio on a number of projects, and I got to know the band because, you know, again, this is what happened at that time. It was a community of performers and writers and artists and filmmakers and everything that all hung around that hive that was Win Mullane. And we all met and everybody, you know, it was a little enclave, if you like. And so everyone got to know everybody. And then they had been working with Steve Lillywhite. And for whatever reason, there was a pause in that project. And Paul McGuinness asked me if I would go in and work with the band. Mm. So I went in and I produced a track called The Refugee.
Ah.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the... Oh, the refugee.
That's it. Come
on, back at me. Wow. Yeah. Whoa. So, did you have to produce that?
Yeah.
My word.
Yeah.
Didn't know that, Bill.
Yeah.
It's a great track.
Yeah, it's a good track.
Do they still do it?
Not sure.
They left it behind, maybe?
Well,
that's a brilliant track. Yeah. Is that War?
And it's, War. And it's kind of very, right now, it's very, very relevant, isn't it?
Jesus, yeah.
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 Yeah, so that was that's great. Brilliant. That was great fun. And then I'd been working with another band at the time that you may or may not know, called Minor Detail.
No, never.
Okay.
Gone from my...
They were the first band to ever be signed directly out of Ireland to an American record company.
My word.
Yeah, two brothers from Capel Street, originally, the Hughes brothers.
I love hearing these stories.
Yeah, and I remember we were working in the studio, it was around the time I did The Refugee, and we were working in the studio, and I got a phone call one day in the studio in Winbull. Mm. And this girl said, the receptionist, Caroline, she said, Bill, this CBS Records in America. And I said, must be for you too. No, Bill, they're looking for you. I said, what? So I picked up the phone and this guy said, hello, Bill Whelan. I said, yeah. And he said, we've got a couple of demos here that you did with a band called Minor Detail. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, oh, wow, yeah. He said, we love it. Mm. We really love it. Mm. And that started a whole thing where over the coming months, I was to see guys flying in.
Oh, yeah.
Head of Elektra Records came in on Concorde.
Oh, God, yeah. Ireland, after U2.
Yeah.
Ireland became basically this place where A&R men from all over the world just flew in and flew went, in. Where's the bag it in?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And they just go there and they go, I'm signing him.
Yeah.
And it was just like maybe just a guy just getting up onto the stage, just putting pints back.
Yeah.
And they go, I'm signing him. No, he's not actually an artist. It doesn't matter. He looks great and he's Irish.
Well, no, in the case of...
So what happened to Minor Detail?
Minor Detail, I would have to say, were the most exciting thing I've ever seen happen.
Really?
Yeah, it was incredible. It was incredible. And they, you know...
What was their type?
It was kind of... it was electro-pop, but with a spiritual part to it, you know. They were two brothers. They wrote these songs and sang them. The lead singer was really John Hughes, and John had one of those voices that it didn't matter what you put under him in terms of the production, he just sat on top of it. He had one of those voices that really occupied the space on a record, you know. So anyway, we made the record, and they ultimately signed, after a lot of kind of traffic from A&R guys, they signed to Polygram. And in a very short time, the first single was a single called "The Canvas of Life," and it entered the American charts. And then something happened in the record company, and the guy who was their champion in the record company was actually the head of the record company. He one day came in and security emptied out his desk and put him out in the street, and they had lost their champion in the record company.
Happens so many times.
And that was the end. That was, even though they got a big advance, they made three videos. When Mullane made the videos, it was an amazing time, and it just faded.
And had the champion remained, do you think they could have gone on to do well?
I would have no doubt about
really?
It.
Really, did they have the? Let me ask you the ingredients. Did they have the determination?
Oh, unquestionably.
Talent.
Yeah.
Desire.
Yeah.
Did they have material?
Yeah.
The ability to write more material?
I think so.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
And they could have done it.
I think they could have done it, and it didn't happen. But can I give you the coda? So for a good few years then, Minor Detail kind of vanished, and that was the end of it. And then John Hughes and I kept in touch, and we did a couple of projects together. He put together the talent for The Commitments.
Ah.
And, you know, he had a great eye for talent.
Okay.
And he put together the talent for The Commitments. And as part of that, I was doing a TV show at the time called An Eye on the Music. And we gave a spot to one of those people that he had seen when he was auditioning The Commitments. And they were a band from Dundalk.
Of course.
Correct.
Yeah.
And John Hughes became the manager
of the course. Hey, John Hughes wins.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So,
do you know actually who's on the line now?
Who?
So I don't know how you did this.
What? Who's
Jim Corr's on the line.
Ah, go away.
Say hello to him.
Hi, Jim.
Hello, Bill. And it's lovely to hear your stories about Andrea and Sharon and Caroline and myself and John Hughes. And boy, his boat came in.
It did.
But that's not why I'm ringing you.
Go on, Jim.
Have you heard of the New World Order, Bill?
No.
Do you know that the people running the record companies in the United States are lizards?
Go on.
It's run by the Illuminati.
Right.
Well, that's T, but I can't pronounce the T. Illuminati. And they are at present launching plans to take over not only the world, but I think they're at your house at the moment down in Limerick, Bill. And while you're here, they're ransacking your house.
Go on.
They are.
God, Jim. Can we do
They
anything?
Found out that you made a lot of money through that river dance, and they wanted to fund their new world order. That's all I'm saying. If you look it up, Bill Whelan, lizards on the internet, you'll find everything.
Jim, thanks a million for that. That's really helpful.
No problem. And you can come and you can log on to my... Well, it's encrypted now. Nobody can get on it. But anyway, if you want to just check out my website, jimcorrnewworldorder.com/reptilesbillhughes.
Jim, do you know you're a great songwriter? Do you know that?
I've forgotten how to write it. Which ones did I write again?
You wrote
Walk Across Borders or something.
You were
Runaway, was it?
We did the first demos. Do you remember that, Jim?
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
Runaway was my favourite.
That's right.
But then I went completely mad.
Yeah. Did you?
I did, yeah. God, I have no problem saying that. I'm out of me cake altogether.
Jesus. Louis Walsh is on the line, Bill.
Oh, Louis.
Say hello to Louis.
Louis and I work together with Johnny Logan.
Say hello to him.
Oh, hi, Louis.
Bill, it's incredible to talk to you. I always said, Bill, you're going to be huge. You're going to be huge. You are a star, Bill. And those guys, minor detail, I tried to sign them, but I ended up with the Carter twins instead. I thought I did. You know, people always ask me, where did the Carter twins first meet? The worst question that you could ask them.
Yeah, go on.
They're twins, Bill.
Oh, get it. I get it.
That's a real story, Bill. You know that?
Is it really?
Tony Fenton. God love him.
Go away. Yeah. He asked.
He had the Carter twins in studio. Right, maybe he was a bit nervous. And the lads are there.
I've got the Carter twins in the studio. I don't know what their names are. John.
How are you?
Yeah. Simon. Yeah. Simon. How are you, Carter twins?
He said, how are you, Tony? How are you, Tony?
Tony went, come here, where did you guys first meet?
He did.
Oh, God
help us.
He did.
It's nearly up there with Marty Whelan going,
oh, that's a wonderful sound. Oh, that's a wonderful sound from the new Australian band, oh, In Inks with Michael Hutchins. Inks. In excess.
I think he called him Bell 11 as well.
Bell 11.
Atlantis Morrissey.
Atlantis Morrissey.
Yeah.
And tell us about working with Kate Bush. What's she like? Always fancied Kate Bush. Now you have to remember now.
Yeah.
I was a man of a certain age, and she was a woman of a certain age. And like you know, a lot of lonely nights spent thinking of Kate Bush.
Yeah. She was. We did three. I worked on three albums with her. And she came here. She was just lovely. I mean, I can't say enough about her.
Does she have any Waterford connections, do you
she
know?
She does. Yeah. Her mother.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know I'm from Waterford?
Oh, are you?
Yeah, I'm from Waterford.
Okay, yeah.
So we always try to claim our own. Val Dionican by.
Yeah, that's right.
Val Dionican by. He's from Waterford.
Gilbert.
Gilbert. He? Gilbert O'Sullivan by.
Yeah.
Not in rhymed.
Not in
by. You know, when I'm drinking Napoleon brandy by, eating more than enough apple pie. Am I being a good boy? Am I your pride and joy? Mother, please, if you please, say I am. Now, that's Gilbert O'Sullivan. That's his real voice, boy. Hello on again, naturally.
Okay.
So, but Kate, she's been a bit of Waterford in her.
Yeah.
And I never ask common questions, as you know, Bill.
I know.
Was she stunningly attractive?
Yeah.
In real life?
Yeah, she was. She was. Although I have a great... Great experience. My youngest son was around the house one day when she came in, and I love this.
I love these fly on the wall. Yeah. So I'm making a cup of tea anyway, right?
Yes.
And then Kate Bush just wambles in the door.
Right, yes. And so he was sitting beside her, and
did she go, "Hey, Bill, it's me, oh, Kathy." Sorry, bad joke.
So she was sitting beside him, and I said, "Brian, say hello to Kate Bush." And he kind of looked suspiciously at her. And then, you know, she was just wearing a pair of jeans and a Gansey and looked very cash. And he kind of looked at her for a little bit, didn't say very much. And then he got up and walked out of the kitchen from the fireplace and went into where the records were. And he came back out after about 5 minutes with the Dreaming album in his hand.
Mm.
And he looked at it. He was holding up the sleeve of the record, and he looked at it. And there's Kate, and I don't know if you know the sleeve, but she's kind of whispering to somebody, and she's got her tongue out, and there's a ring on the tongue. She looks absolutely beautiful, and Brian is looking at this and looking at her and looking at this and looking at her, and eventually he said, "You're not Kate Bush."
Did he? It's like straight out of Father Ted.
And he kind of walked out.
It's like Dougal and Father Ted or
exactly,
something. Yeah.
And
I presume
she loved that.
And I presume she was lovely as well.
She was.
I mean,
she
just.
She'd a fantastic sense of humour.
Did she?
Oh, fantastic.
Does she, rather?
She does.
She does she?
Yeah.
And
isn't it great to see her the revitalization of Kate with running up that hill.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. But she is she's a I don't, you know, this word is overused, genius, but she's a genius, I think.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah, she's a musical genius.
Absolutely. And, yeah. And, you know, she had an absolutely very personal view of where she was going with every track, you know. And
very personal view, yeah.
Yeah, and real, like, she really focused in on it. And she wasn't, you know, it wasn't so intense that you couldn't have a light moment. She'd release, every now and then she'd pull the release button and everyone would have a laugh. Yeah. And then we're back. She had that lovely way of working, you know, which was great. And
and were you involved with her on Hounds of Love?
Yeah.
And Running Up That Hill?
No, I didn't do Running Up That Hill, but it was on that album.
Hounds of Love.
Jig of Life.
I love that cloud busting and all that stuff.
She's
terrific, isn't
she? A unique voice, yeah.
Unique voice. And tell me a bit about writing jingles. This is fascinating, of course, because, you know, the commercial area. You wrote, so for example, did you write the Surfer one for Guinness?
I did, yeah.
Those of you listening of a certain vintage, because you wouldn't get the Surfer one, Guinness used to have these kind of filmed cinematic Guinness ads, which they still do. But basically, in a world where ads, back then, they used to make ads like they made feature films. I mean, ads would have a budget of a million quid. And, you know, it might only last 30 seconds or a minute or whatever, but they and there was this one with the fella on a skateboard, and Kirsty Boer ended up singing about it, and he says, "I don't know how your man stood on the skateboard after 14 pints of stout."
Yeah.
Because it's like, how could you be skateboarding if you'd had 14 pints of Guinness? Because it was an ad for Guinness and a fella skate. And did you write that one?
I think it was surfboarding.
Surfing.
Yeah, it was the surfing commercial. Yeah, I did. And
that would have paid well.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And there was, the thing about jingles was, and you've referred to it, there was always a good budget.
Mm.
And the music always had a good budget.
Mm.
So if you got a phone call from an agency saying, "We're doing a Guinness commercial," you could be sure that, you know,
that's the mortgage paper.
Things were going to be okay for this month.
Yeah.
So I did lots of, Sean Davey and I had an office together, and he wrote commercials and I wrote commercials for everything from, you know, 50-50 cashback. You wouldn't remember that.
The 50-50 cashback. The 50-50 cash. That's only
half prize cash. Yeah.
You didn't write the Bears, did you?
No, they were in it though.
The Bears.
They?
Yeah, the Bears.
Weren't they?
Yeah. What else did you write? Catch It If You Can.
No.
Catch It If You Can on the outside of chocolate and underneath the chocolate are Krispies. I know all these ads from the 60s and 70s. Yeah. Sorry, 70s, because I grew up just watching fucking television all the time.
Because
that's all we could do. Watch RTE1 and RTE2.
Yeah.
You know? Ads.
Yeah, yeah. So it was good. The whole jingle thing was good. And it was good training as well. You know, working to picture. Very often you worked to picture and wrote and constructed the music to the picture. So that was good training if you wanted to write music for film.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I did.
You didn't write the Flake one, though, did you?
No.
You know, remember the Flake one?
Only
the crumbliest, flakiest chocolate tastes like chocolate never tasted before. Flake.
Oh. Oh my God. Okay. We did lots of them. Lots of the old
Toblerone?
No, not Toblerone. Oh, romantic things like turf briquettes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we did. Yeah.
What? What was that?
John Sheehan.
No.
Exactly.
That's a beautiful piece of music. You produced that one. And John, did John write it?
John wrote it.
That's a lovely song, isn't it?
Yeah. But in fact I recorded that with him on the Dubliners album.
Yeah.
And
that's lovely.
Yeah.
I think one of the best things you can be in life, but especially in entertainment, is grafter. Is a grafter, a person who just gets up and fucking does it.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is that element of entrepreneurism in, you know, there's a notion that we like our artists to be poor and stuff, you know, and in a garret and you know, probably die young, you know, that kind of thing. Nonsense. You know, I mean, look at Yeats. Yeats was an entrepreneur. He ran a theatre. Joyce ran a cinema. Mm. You know,
Bernard Shaw lived till 95.
Yeah, exactly.
Was working all the time.
But the notion that you sit around and wait for the thing to happen, it may not. Yeah. You have to give it a hand.
Yeah.
Get out there. And
also people like Madonna, etc.
Yeah.
They basically spend their whole lives being entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
They go, right, that phase of my career is over. I'm going to reinvent myself entirely. I'm going to put pointy cones on my chest to call them breasts.
Yeah.
And that's my new phase. And you go, right, who's coming up with that? She is. I mean, yeah. she's seeing influences from all over the place, but she's driving it.
Yeah.
She's the entrepreneur. Listen, Bill, we've come to the end because, we could go into the Tom Dunn realms here and just talk for another 5 hours about music. I urge everybody to get Bill Whelan, The Road to Riverdance. It's a beautiful looking book. And Bill, you've told me some great stories that some of them would be germane to the book. It's been a real pleasure meeting you. I had never met you before. A real joy. And thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks, Mario. Up Waterford. And
up to Dacia, boy.
And to Dacia.
I'll never get over Gilbert O'Sullivan singing in a Waterford accent. Thank you so much. And my thanks to Bill Whelan for his incredible company. We spent about 2 hours together chatting, and that's an edited down version of everything we talked about. My thanks to you for listening, and my thanks to Rog for giving us the comedy inspiration this week for the voicemails. See you same time, same place next week. Bye-bye.